There's more to classic Gothic literature than monsters and the supernatural.
We think of the Gothic as to do with terror and fright, but it also helps us confront those devils. It helps us look them in the face and then decide what we do with them.
Coming up, Madeline Potter helps us find what Europe's scariest stories can teach us about ourselves. While Mexico's Day of the Dead festivities are becoming more popular across North America, Luisa Navarro reminds us of its deep roots designed to help us face our mortality.
This is an authentic Mexican tradition that stems from pre-Hispanic times.
And hear what you might actually encounter on a ghost tour of old New Orleans.
I had people burst into tears. I had people try to run out of the room. I had one girl swear that she had been slapped in the face.
Come along with us for the hour ahead if you dare. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Why do you see so many marigold flowers on the altars people make for the Day of the Dead? Coming up on today's Travel with Rick Steves, we'll hear what's behind the Mexican traditions that are growing in popularity north of the Rio Grande. There are also many reasons New Orleans can feel haunted by its past. A local tour guide tells us what happens on her ghost tours of the city. Let's start out today looking at the role Gothic literature plays in dealing with our mortality. In Europe, scary stories can be set in shadowy castles, foggy moors, or eerie landmarks that inspired 19th century authors to write about monsters, vampires, and things that go bump in the night. Our guide to Gothic literature is Madeline Potter. She was raised in a Roma family in post-communist Romania and holds a PhD in English literature from the University of York. Dr. Potter joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to remind us of places that inspired novelists to concoct their nightmare fantasies. Madeline, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Rick, for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So you're featuring places that have a connection with this whole Gothic sensibility. Now, I know about thin places in my travels. There are places
lovely.
That are close to heaven. But you're into murky places, places that are close to the monsters and vampires and whatever hell is. Tell us about Gothic places, Gothic literature, and how it relates to tourism.
Yeah. So Gothic literature emerged roughly in the late 18th century. It emerged from this movement called Romanticism that emphasized a turn to emotions. And I'm simplifying a little bit here because otherwise I'll be here till tomorrow. And expressions of individuality. And Gothic literature turns to the dark side of these things and turns to the past, turns to the medieval world, looks at hauntings, and also, obviously, monsters, very famously Frankenstein and Dracula. And I think, in a way, thinking about what Gothic literature tells us about being human is a journey, is traveling, but it's traveling inside ourselves. But if you want to check some literary places that are related to the Gothic, you might want to start in Transylvania, but also Lake Geneva, where Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was famously born, as well as John Polidori's The Vampire, one of the earliest prose fictions that we have in the English language that features a creature that we might today recognize as a vampire.
Okay, now before we get into all of these individual places, Maddie, I would like to first of all straighten out the word Gothic. To me, Gothic is medieval architecture, and it was named as an insult of the Goths because Goths were a barbarian tribe. So the people that came after Gothic said, well, that's old-fashioned. Let's call it barbarian or Gothic. So there's that Gothic. There's the Goth sort of counterculture that we see today. And then there's Gothic literature. Mm-hmm. What do they have in common? I mean, what do Goths walking the streets with their dark demeanors today have to do with Gothic literature and Gothic architecture?
Yeah, well, Gothic literature is associated in many ways with Gothic architecture. So when it started, you get these ruined abbeys. And
that's it. So that is the connection, just Gothic ruins. It's a great setting for a Gothic novel.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's always some kind of ruined abbey. But also it is associated because the rise of Gothic literature in Britain is partly related to translations of dark romantic literature from Germany. So there is that sense of the Germanic, the Gothic.
Would that be like scary fairy tales?
There are a lot of, there's the theme, for example, there are German ballads and there are German stories about the undead lover.
Undead. See, there's a great term.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not alive, but they're not dead.
Yeah, exactly. They're in between. So often Gothic literature in Britain and Ireland was sometimes described as the German craze. So there is that sense of the Germanic, the Gothic. And then the goth subculture emerged from the post-punk era. It was mostly associated with bands such as The Cure or Joy Division. And then it flourished with this aesthetics that draws on dark clothing, vampiric looks, but also, yeah, more broadly a fascination with ruins and gothic literature. But the goth subculture is still primarily associated with music and fashion.
But it does have that connection then.
Absolutely.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Madeline Potter. Her upcoming book is called Theological Monsters, Religion and Irish Gothic. To learn more about Madeline and her work, you can go to madeline-potter.com. Well, let's talk about sightseeing if you're interested in goth culture and gothic literature. First of all, got to start with Transylvania and Vlad Dracula. Isn't that sort of the, if you were going to have a greatest hits of gothic tourism, Transylvania?
Definitely Transylvania, yeah.
The castle. And it's, I've been there. I think it's a terrible tourist trap.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And what's really interesting is a Bran castle that you've been to.
Yeah, the Bran castle.
Yeah. So what's really funny is that historically, it's quite likely that Vlad Dracula never set foot there.
Right.
It's not his actual castle. His castle, it was in Wallachia because he was a Wallachian ruler, and it's called Poenar Castle.
Well, they got to get their promotional budget together then, because Bran is getting all the money.
Yes, but it's become Romania's Gothic tourism hub. And if you go to Transylvania now around the castle, you will see trinkets with vampires on them and red wine marketed as blood.
Okay, my goal as a tour guide is to take that goofy tourism gimmick and drawing some kind of worthwhile history or story out of it. What's something worthwhile we can derive from the goofy story of Vlad Dracula and sucking blood in a castle that he never went to?
Well, there are still superstitions that are still very much alive in Transylvania. People do still very much, especially in more rural communities, believe in these things. Now, I grew up in Romania in what would be historically the region of Transylvania, although now it's considered, it's just on the outskirts. Growing up there, I grew up with people actually hanging garlic garlands on their windows on St. Andrew's Eve to keep at bay the strigoi, or the vampires, as they're called. Now, imagine when I became a scholar of Gothic literature and I'm writing about Dracula and I'm seeing Bram Stoker describe Transylvania, describe these places that I knew as a child. It's very, very interesting that Bram Stoker, he was an Irish writer who was thinking about the condition of Ireland as well to a certain extent. And what's interesting is that there are parallels between the ethnic and religious tensions of Ireland and the ethnic and religious tensions of Transylvania. Transylvania is, you know, Romania is the land of Romanians. Wallachia is the land of Wallachians. England is the land of the Angles. Whereas Transylvania doesn't have that. It's the land across the forest, Transylva. It's kind of a vantage point, which in a way makes it Gothic itself, right? Because you can't really fix it, pin it down to something. And in Transylvania, there are Catholics, there are Orthodox people, there are Protestants, Calvinists, there are Romanians, there are Germans, there are Hungarians.
The German communities are fascinating because they're little enclaves of Germany that are more traditional than Germany today. So this is all fun to look at these broader connections. Now, when we think back to Bram Stoker, he may have been Irish, but wasn't he inspired by ruins? I know these ruins on the cliffs of Whitby in England.
Yeah, he vacationed in Whitby. And it's very funny because he was actually in Whitby when, if we look at Bram Stoker's working notes to Dracula, he was going to set it initially in Styria, where Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu sets his own vampire novella, Carmilla. And he was going to call the Count, Count Vampire.
Vampire?
Yeah.
Vampire the Vampire.
Exactly. which I don't think would have been as successful.
No, Vlad Dracula is much better.
Exactly. So when he was in Whitby, he went to the library and found this book on the history of the Romanian principalities. And that's where he came across the name Dracula and Transylvania. So you can see in his notes to Dracula when he's crossing out Styria and replacing it with Transylvania.
But this is so interesting that a writer could be writing about a place that maybe he's never even been and have a big impact on it, you know?
But you know what's interesting is that I think he really captures the atmosphere of Transylvania, even though he had never been.
But today, apparently there's a goth festival in Whitby. What would a goth festival be like?
So people go to Whitby and they listen to goth music and they really dress up as...
So it's goth. Yeah, it's this subculture of goth people that came out of punk rock.
Yeah, it is.
But it's no accident it's in Whitby, right there in the shadow of this ruined gothic building that inspired Dracula.
Yeah, it's very much to do with the legacy of Bram Stoker's Whitby.
And you're living and working in Edinburgh now,
and
that also has some connections. What would those be?
Edinburgh has a history of body snatching, which was this practice of essentially excavating bodies that had just been buried so that they could be sold to anatomists because there was a ban on
dissection for medical study.
Exactly. And if you read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which isn't set in Edinburgh, but it engages with that sort of background, Victor Frankenstein describes himself as walking through the charnel houses. So we do wonder how Victor might have acquired the parts that he needed to assemble the creature. And John Polidori, who wrote The Vampire, he was a student at the University of Edinburgh. He studied medicine here.
So you teach.
I do.
Just to wrap up our conversation, Maddie, what can Gothic literature teach us about being human? Why does it matter?
I think it makes us understand the darker sides of humanity. I think we need monsters to understand who we are. We need these projections to look inside ourselves. Because if you look at human history, there's been so much tragedy. And we wonder, where does this come from? It's humanity itself that's capable of great violence and great evil. We think of the Gothic as to do with terror and fright, but it also helps us confront those devils. It helps us look them in the face and then decide what we do with them, how we fight them, and how we understand them so that we can move beyond them.
Madeline Potter, best wishes with your teaching, and thanks again.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Madeline Potter's book, Theological Monsters, Religion and Irish Gothic, examines how 19th century literature explores knowledge of the divine. It's due to be released in April 2026 by the University of Wales Press. Maddie also pays tribute to her family's heritage in The Roma, A Traveling History. You can hear about that on program number 802 in the Travel with Rick Steves archives. As one of the oldest cities in North America, New Orleans is also said to be one of its most haunted. We'll hear what you might encounter on a ghost tour of the city in just a bit. But first, let's learn what's behind Mexico's Day of the Dead. Death is universal, inescapable, and it's our fate. As humans, we're connected by this thread of mortality and the inevitability that one day we will all take our last breaths. We can choose to embrace it or we can fear it. In the Mexican culture, there's a colorful festival in which the living and the dead reunite. Families create a mantle decorated with flowers, offerings, pictures, and significant symbols. In the streets, adults and children paint their faces like skeletons, and vibrant orange and yellow marigolds decorate the walls, drape the doorways, and hang in ornate designs everywhere you look. Life and death are celebrated together over a two-day holiday each November at All Souls Day that we've come to know as the Day of the Dead. Journalist Louisa Navarro is a Mexican-American who spent time connecting with her roots and appreciating her heritage. She's written the book Mexico's Day of the Dead, and Louisa joins us now to share her understanding of Día de los Muertos. Louisa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. It is such a pleasure and an honor to join you today to talk about Día de Muertos, or Day of the Dead.
And you've written a gorgeous book about that. And what inspired you to delve into this really colorful and popular but often misunderstood or not totally understood holiday?
Yeah, so I am Mexican-American. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. And when I was a child, my mom would decorate our home with skeletons during the Day of the Dead season. And if I'm being honest with you, I kind of thought it was strange and I was afraid. And I didn't necessarily connect with that side of my culture in the beginning. But it wasn't until my cousin, who was 24 years old and she was my best friend, her name was Lila, she passed away. And I really struggled with her loss and I didn't know what to do. And that was when I realized, wow, I'm so fortunate that I am Mexican because I can turn to my culture for help and guidance. And I started getting really into it and learning the process of what it is to build an altar.
So you really recognized in a practical, hands-on way, dealing with the sad death of a friend, that this can be approached. The traditional celebrating of the Day of the Dead helps people deal with death.
Exactly. You know, I think that one of the saddest parts about death isn't necessarily death itself, but it's the fact that we're almost not allowed to talk about the people who have died anymore because we make people feel uncomfortable. And so when I lost my cousin Lila, I felt like I wasn't allowed to talk about her anymore. But thanks to our tradition, thanks to the Día de Muertos, Day of the Dead, I am allowed to talk about her and celebrate her once a year and all my other relatives who have passed away. And it's so beautiful. And I hope to inspire other people to do the same all around the world.
Now, Louise, it's interesting, as I was reading through your book and thinking about this, the Day of the Dead in Mexico and in Latin America, it coincides with Halloween, and it also coincides with All Saints Day.
Correct.
And that's the day at my church when we bring pictures of people, loved ones who have died, and they're put up on a table in front of the church, and there's candles, and we remember the dead. How is that happening all on the same day? What's the connection with this pre-Christian, indigenous Latin American celebration and this Christian Catholic celebration and all of this Halloween goblins and skeletons? That's a very interesting happening at a certain time of year.
Of course. And first, I want to emphasize the fact that Día de Muertos is not Mexican Halloween at all. It is not meant to be a scary holiday or a silly holiday. It is meant to be a holiday where we come together, have dinner, place the pictures of our loved ones and honor them and celebrate their memory. You know, I grew up celebrating both Halloween and Day of the Dead, but they're completely different holidays. Originally, the reason that we are so lucky to have Day of the Dead is thanks to the indigenous people of Mexico. It's a pre-Hispanic tradition, and it was actually originally celebrated in late July and early August to honor the goddess of death, known as Mictlantecuhtli. What the indigenous people did is they would burn copal incense. They would, like you said, decorate with flower garlands, specifically marigolds, which are known as cempasúchil. That's the indigenous word. And they would make tamales. And there was, at the time, some human sacrifice. And eventually what ended up happening was when the Spanish colonized Mexico, they actually did not approve of this celebration at all. And they did try to eradicate the tradition. But the indigenous people would continue to celebrate and honor Mictlantecuhtli secretly. And what the Spanish did was there was this natural syncretism that happened, and they decided to move the celebration to November 1st and November 2nd, which, as many people know in the Catholic religion, is when we celebrate All Souls and All Saints Day, or the people who have died. And that is why the Día de Muertos is now celebrated November 1st and 2nd.
So when we say pre-Hispanic, meaning literally before the Spanish came, before
exactly.
The conquistadors, and when they came, they brought with them their religion, and part of the conquest was to put the Catholic religion on the indigenous people. But in any case, when conquerors come in and take over people, they have to deal with these deeply held feelings, religious feelings that were already there. So a lot of times they will mix it together in a way where it's more palatable for the indigenous people, but it still is the conquering people's religion.
Of course. Yeah, they tried to, eradicate it. They did not believe in this tradition, but it was basically impossible. And so what they did was they blended it.
Yeah. And it's a way to have a multi-day festival welcoming spirits back for a visit. It's
yes.
Kind of a nice thing.
It's my favorite holiday of the entire year. And I think everyone around the world should honor and celebrate their loved ones who have died.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with journalist Luisa Navarro, and she's joining us today to talk about the Day of the Dead, or Día de los Muertos, the Mexican tradition of honoring deceased loved ones. Luisa's written the book Mexico's Day of the Dead, and it features beautiful pictures that capture the colorful celebration all across Mexico. Now, if we're planning a trip, and it happens to be during this season, what should we do? How should we be prepared? Where do we go? What will we see?
I think a wonderful introduction to Día de Muertos, if you've never even been to Mexico before, is to start in Mexico City. They do a parade there, which actually is not an indigenous or centuries-old tradition at all. The only reason the parade started was because of the James Bond film where they made the parade, and then Mexico City basically decided, we love this, and we're going to buy the floats and the props and continue this tradition. But the reason I say that is I think it's a good way to start if you're feeling overwhelmed. And you can also visit the cemetery in Mexico City. There's a cemetery.
So the cemeteries are sort of the ground zero of this kind of celebration?
I mean, the cemetery is definitely where you're going to see, you know, Día de Muertos in action, but it's not the only way to celebrate. And I will say that if you decide to visit a cemetery, you have to do it in a respectful way. So the best way to do that is to somehow connect with a family. And what I mean by that is, like, I would personally recommend that you were invited to the cemetery.
Yeah.
There's also different ways to celebrate Día de Muertos. It's actually celebrated all over Mexico City. Some parts are more traditional than others. For example, that's why we chose to cover specifically Mexico City, Oaxaca, and Michoacán, which is where my grandmother was from and which is very, very famous for Día de Muertos.
Is it a day or a season? I understand from your book that it's several days.
It's several days. It starts typically October 31st around midnight. So that's when a lot of families do go to the cemeteries. But it just depends on where you are in Mexico because the traditions can vary. But it goes from October 31st, November 1st through November 2nd. So here in the United States, we start Halloween like decorating October 1st. I wouldn't say that Día de Muertos is like that. And a tip I would say is get closer to October 31st when you travel so that you can make the most of your experience and actually see all the decorations.
How can we be inspired by the Day of the Dead? Is it for the local people, what does it mean? Is it part of any religion or is it kind of parallel to people's religion or lack of religion?
Yeah, I think it just depends on the family. I think that some people's altars are, you know, they do showcase more of Catholicism and you'll find a cross or a virgin displayed on it. Others are less religious. It just depends on the family, but it doesn't matter what religion you are or what your beliefs are, but to maybe pause once a year, have a dinner, you know, maybe display some photographs of your loved ones who have passed away and just take that time to pause and share their stories among family and friends and honor them no matter where you live.
So it's a way to keep lost loved ones' memories alive. Is that fundamentally what it is, would you say?
100%. It's a way for us to continue celebrating our loved ones who have died.
My sister lost her son, and the most emotional, heartbreaking thing for her is a lot of people forget him, and
yes,
she will never forget him.
Yes.
And with this, you keep that person's spirit alive, and you keep them with you. And apparently that's a balm. It's a soothing blessing for people who celebrate the Day of the Dead, more than just a bunch of ghoulish skeletons and so on. It has that colorful indigenous vibe, but it's also a very practical thing to keep loved ones remembered. And of course, they're gone, they're dead, and who knows what's next, but they can be remembered. And that's a beautiful thing for the people who've suffered that loss.
100%. I think the biggest gift that you can give to someone who has suffered a loss is to tell that person that you have not forgotten their loved
right.
one, or like your sister, her son. And
I'm
maybe
give
even
this
send
book to
a
my
little
sister.
Gift.
My
yeah.
sister would love this.
You know, something that maybe she would want to do an altar. And you'd be surprised, Rick, the number of people that have reached out to me who are not Mexican on direct message or email to say, I want to celebrate.
Luisa Navarro is a first-generation Mexican-American raised in Dallas and author of the newly released photo book, Mexico's Day of the Dead, a celebration of life through stories and photos. She's helping us right now on Travel with Rick Steves to better understand the beauty of Mexican culture and what goes into its distinctive Day of the Dead observances. Luisa's website and blog posts feature places to visit in Mexico, plus instructions for building your own altar for the Day of the Dead. It's at mexicoinmypocket.com. And that's also the name of the gift shop that she runs on Court Street in Brooklyn, New York. Let's talk about what's in that altar, because you actually have a build your own altar kind of chapter in the book. It's fascinating. Tell us, what are the elements of the altar?
There are so many different elements in my book. I think I cover over 22 elements. But some of the traditional elements are, you want to provide a bienvenida, or a welcome, for the spirits. And so you want to make sure that you display their favorite foods, you display their favorite drinks, that you place the marigolds, because the marigold scent is what guides the spirit to us. And the color is said to be the only color that they can see. So that's why marigolds are one of the most important elements. I like to decorate with little monarch butterflies in honor of my grandmother, who was from Michoacan, and where the Purépecha natives believe that due to the migration of these butterflies, which migrate all the way from Canada to Michoacan during this time of year, they believe it's our spirits coming back to visit us. And so I really like to put the monarch butterflies on my altar. Even though it's not necessarily a traditional element, it's a great way to connect with my lineage and my heritage and that story. There are so many different elements that I get into in the book.
And then do you redo the same? Do you save that altar and bring it out every year? Or do you leave it up all year? Or do you build it from scratch every year?
It's a great question. Honestly, the first altar you build will feel very overwhelming, especially because you're dealing with those emotions. My first altar was nothing special, nothing fancy. I felt very overwhelmed. So I started with just simple pictures, marigolds, candles to light the path. And then what I've done is I have a little box, and I save all of the pictures of my relatives, and I save all of these elements. And little by little, I've gotten better and better at learning these traditions. And I hope to encourage other people to not feel overwhelmed by the process, and to know that they can really do what feels best in their heart and just build something with love. Like, that's really what it's about.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Luisa Navarro. Her book is Mexico's Day of the Dead. And we're getting a deeper understanding than just a sightseeing, a colorful opportunity for a photograph. Luisa, there is, it seems, one iconic symbol of the Day of the Dead, and that is La Catrina. Can
Yes.
you tell us a little bit about La Catrina?
Of course. So as a tourist, if you travel to Mexico and you go to the markets, or you see the decorations, or you see people dressed up in skeletal imagery, that is La Catrina, and she is a skeletal woman who is dressed in European clothing with a feather hat. And she was actually originally created by a political cartoonist known as José Guadalupe Posada. And what José Guadalupe Posada was doing is that when he created that cartoon, he was making fun of women and people who would deny their indigenous roots. And his message with that skeleton was, he was saying that no matter who we are, rich or poor, brown or white, we all become skeletons at the end of the day, and we should not deny our roots, our heritage. And the way that she became known as La Catrina, she actually became famous. She wasn't famous at that time. She was actually known as La Calavera Garbancera. And what La Calavera Garbancera translates to, when José created her, is the chickpea skeleton. And the reason he called her the chickpea skeleton is he was making fun of the vendors who would sell chickpeas instead of rice and beans. And chickpeas, obviously, were introduced by the Spanish. So eventually, Diego Rivera, the most famous Mexican muralist, I mean, he's like everything, was a huge fan of José Guadalupe Posada. And he decided to place La Catrina in the center of his mural, one of his most famous
okay.
murals. And he coined that phrase, La Catrina. And the reason he named her La Catrina is, traditionally in Spanish, the word Catrín translates to a dandy man dressed in pinstripe pants and, you know, a suit and a bowler hat. And so he was also making fun of these women who dressed up and denied their indigenous roots. So he created the word Catrina, which is basically the feminine version of Catrín. And yeah, it's a little bit of a tricky subject, but I think it's so important that if you're going to celebrate Day of the Dead, you need to know who La Catrina is.
A lot of us will be going to Mexico not during Halloween season. forgive me for relating it to Halloween, but we just think of Halloween. That's the last day in October. Or people who are into the church calendar, All Saints Day, the next day. But if you're in Latin America, this would be the Day of the Dead. If you're going to Mexico outside of that time, when you go to Mexico City, there's that wonderful cultural museum, what is it called? The Museum of Archaeology.
Yes, archaeology and
that
anthropology.
And
yes.
You've got to see. I would imagine there's a whole room full of Day of the Dead art in there.
Yes, actually, I'm so happy you mentioned that because I think it is a top must that you have to visit when you go. And one of the cool parts is if you go there, you will see the original pre-Hispanic skeletal imagery that inspired all of Day of the Dead. So you'll see the goddess of death honored. You'll see the god of death and those pre-Hispanic statues.
We're out of time, Louisa, but I'd love to just have you finish by, let's pretend I'm with you. It's Day of the Dead and you're going to light a candle and we're going to approach the altar that you have in your house. What are we going to think about? What are we going to look at? And what's going through your mind?
One of my favorite things when I put my altar together is I like to place images of not just my grandparents, but my great-grandparents. And I actually place the image of the day they got married. And so when I place those images, I like to think back and think about that day and how special it was for them and how much it would have been amazing for me to experience it with them. But I really think about their stories and how I hope that they're happy that their great-granddaughter is still celebrating and honoring their memory and their stories and sharing it with her own family.
That's beautiful. Louisa Navarro, thanks for writing Mexico's Day of the Dead, and best wishes as you embrace life in such a creative and beautiful way.
Thank you, Rick. This was incredible. I'm so grateful for the opportunity.
La Catrina canta, la Catrina canta, tú lo sabes.
We have a short web extra from today's interview with Louisa about what you should and should not do when visiting cemeteries in Mexico. You can hear it where today's show is posted at ricksteves.com/radio. Get ready to visit the spookier side of New Orleans next on Travel with Rick Steves. There's just something about the humid air that hangs heavy in New Orleans that makes you want to believe the city's many ghost stories and legends. As one of America's oldest cities, it has a spooky reputation and old mansions that could easily have you believing that they're haunted and sometimes come with a grisly past. To help us explore the legends of haunted New Orleans, we're joined now by a local tour guide, Sandy Hester. She offers walking tours of the city with a company called Free Tours by Foot New Orleans. She joins us from the studios of our affiliate, WWNO, on the campus of the University of New Orleans. Sandy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So New Orleans is sort of known as a place with a strong presence of ghosts and spirits, more than other cities. Why is that?
I think it's multi-layered. I think part of it would be the location of the city, which is basically in a humid swamp where you had numerous diseases and death sort of hanging in the air on a day-to-day basis. There have been several tragedies that have occurred, two major devastating fires where a large section of the city burned to the ground. But I also think it has a lot to do as well with a marketing ploy, as it does with anything else, of how to lure in tourism, because for some strange reason, humans like a good chill down their spine. They like a good scare, a controlled scare.
It's kind of like York and Edinburgh in Britain. Those are the two cities that for some reason have all the ghosts, and they sure capitalize on that. I think in New Orleans, you've had books that have been set in New Orleans that are scary. You've had TV episodes that feature ghosts set there. What are a few of the ways we might have seen New Orleans on the screen?
Definitely, if you've heard anything to do with Anne Rice, she set her Vampire Chronicles partly in the city of New Orleans. If you're dealing with the religion of voodoo, there's been several movies that have been set, like Angel Heart, in and around the area of New Orleans. Skeleton Key, I believe, was another one. Mm-hmm. Also, almost every television show that's going to deal with ghosts, whether that's American Horror Stories, Coven, the originals being set in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
And when you do visit New Orleans, I think if you're looking for ghosts, you're probably more likely to find them at a cemetery. And there are several cemeteries in New Orleans that really are actually tourist attractions. What makes them worth a visit?
So New Orleans is kind of interesting because we're considered to be sort of the northernmost Caribbean city. And a lot of our culture lines up with the Caribbean, including burying our dead above ground. A lot of people believe that we do that because we're kind of floating on a water table. And don't get me wrong, it definitely facilitates the burial process because initially when the French would have first arrived here and buried the dead below ground, when we had a flood event, they had a nasty habit of popping back up uninvited.
That's enough for a scary story right there.
Yeah, right. And after that occurred a couple of times, they got the bright idea that they would bury them along the levee of the river to put distance between them and the water table, which seems like a bright idea unless you're a structural engineer and you realize you've just punched a bunch of Swiss cheese holes and the only thing holding back the river from the city. So anytime the river would rise, you could potentially have a crevasse right where all of your dead were buried. And so now grandma and grandpa come surfing back into the city. And then they got the idea to wall the cemeteries off, but still bury below ground so that when they popped up, they at least didn't slide into your front yard.
Grandma, I didn't know you could surf. I think there's one cemetery, which is like the number one cemetery to visit, which happens to be called Number Three. What's it like to wander through St. Louis Number Three Cemetery?
So typically the cemetery that most people will want to go to is our oldest extant cemetery. And that one is actually St. Louis Number One. But St. Louis Number Three is located on Esplanade Avenue, and it is sitting over the site of where an old leper colony used to exist in New Orleans, which is always kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But again, if you can wander freely into that cemetery now, a lot of cemeteries have been closed down, but that one still enables you to go in freely on your own and see the above ground architecture, which I think is what is the big draw for people who are coming from other parts of the United States where they're used to having the dead buried in ground. So there's a lot of money being spent on these grandiose mausoleums.
And some of these monuments are like small homes. I mean, it's amazing how ornate they are and how expensive they would be to make.
Well, absolutely. I mean, initially when you were creating these mausoleums, you had a lot of a very high illiteracy rate in the city of New Orleans. And the people that were transporting the bodies to the cemeteries to bury them would not have necessarily been able to read on the outside that this was the family tomb of the person that they were transporting. So usually what you did in regards to those tombs was you made them look similar to your own house, right down to the iron gate that adorned the front.
Yeah.
And even originally, you know, now you see that the cemeteries are whitewashed, but initially they would have been painted typically the colors that your house was painted as well.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by Sandy Hester, and we're talking about ghosts and cemeteries in New Orleans. Sandy's an artist and a writer with a master's degree in history who likes to spin a good yarn in the beloved traditions of Southern storytelling. Most days, you can find her leading walking tours for a company called Free Tours by Foot New Orleans. Their website is freetoursbyfoot.com, and you can click right on through to New Orleans if you're curious about traveling there. So, Sandy, what's your favorite ghost story? Tell us a ghost story.
My favorite ghost story actually centers around, there used to be a bar in New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina called O'Flaherty's Irish Channel Pub, and it centered around a man who was having an affair, unbeknownst to his wife, obviously. And so when she goes out, his mistress shows up at the house one day, and he's enraged over the fact that she would dare to show up at his house when his wife could potentially come back at any moment and surprise them. They get into an argument. He pushes her through the French doors. She hits the railing of the balcony, flips over, and falls to her death below. And so being a fine, upstanding gentleman, he buried her in the courtyard. And then after he had done this, he looks up and he sees an enslaved child has witnessed the entire event. And so he knows he's in trouble and his wife's going to find out and he's going to lose everything. So he ends up going up to the fifth floor of this building and he hanged himself. And it is haunted by all three entities. It's haunted by him, his wife, and the mistress.
That's not a very pleasant place to go.
And whatever you believe as far as ghost stories, and I'm not really sure what I believe as far as what happens to us when we pass on, but there were some moments that occurred on that particular tour, the higher up that you went in the building.
Yeah.
I had people burst into tears. I had people try to run out of the room. I had one girl swear that she had been slapped in the face.
Wow. That has me just scared out of my shoes, but I need more. Tell me another scary story.
So there is a house that's located on Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter, and most people in New Orleans consider it to be the most haunted house in the city. And it is known as the LaLaurie Mansion. Some people will pronounce it LaLaurie. It does feature, to some degree, in American Horror Story's Coven, but it centers around a woman named Delphine LaLaurie, and she is throwing sort of lavish parties at her home, and people, as they go to these parties, are realizing that they never see the same enslaved African twice, which would have been unusual because for a house that particular size, you really wouldn't have needed to have more than about 7 enslaved Africans on site. So they started to ask questions, and it eventually comes out as the house during one of the parties catches fire, and the fire brigade arrives and puts the fire out, that they discover the horrors that have been taking place inside this particular property. And what has been happening is that she has been abusing and executing those enslaved Africans in a room upstairs. And so there are a few surviving enslaved Africans that are brought down in the midst of this party, and the city sort of learns the horrors that have taken place. So the house, the LaLauries, by the way, did make an escape, and she would live out her days in the lap of luxury in Paris. So no one ever really went on trial or was ever punished for what occurred inside of that house, which is probably one of the things that we like to say makes the house probably as haunted and as cursed as it is. But the house will burn almost all the way to the ground by an angry mob, and it sits in ruins for about a decade. And then in the late sort of 1800s, early 1900s, it gets turned into a tenement home for Italians. And they never stay there for very long. They say that it's hard to sleep at night, that there are screams that occur throughout the night. They wake up in the morning to find their animals have been killed, mutilated on the grounds. One man woke up in the night to see a woman leaning over the crib of his infant. He tried to chase her down the hallway. She disappeared. When he came back, his wife was holding on to the child, crying inconsolably because someone had stuffed its sock down its throat. So there's numerous stories like this that occur even coming into the more modern era. There's also the concept that no one can seem to hold on to the house for longer than what the LaLauries held it, which was about 7 years, that it's cursed. One gentleman held it for 3 years. They found him. He had gone stark raving mad in the home, and they admitted him to a mental institution where he would later take his own life. The most famous person that owned the house was, of course, Nicolas Cage. Mm. And they say that he, too, fell prey to the curse because he got himself into some trouble with the IRS and all of his holdings in New Orleans were foreclosed on except this particular piece of property. There was a very prominent doctor that owned the house. So everyone was kind of rooting for him that he was going to push it past the 7th year. And then in the 6th and a half year, he was in an altercation that left him incapacitated, and he lost the house just before the 7th year came around.
Sounds like a charming place for a bed and breakfast.
Yeah. Jeez.
Well, that's a reminder that there's a lot of history, and it's nice history, and it's not nice history. It's a scary history.
Well, you know, I mean, New Orleans was a frontier town. It was rough, really, when you think about it as a port city. It's not initially the nice people that are coming to New Orleans.
That's a good thing to remember. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking ghost stories in New Orleans with our guide, Sandy Hester. Sandy's part of a team of tour guides at the company called Free Tours by Foot New Orleans. It's a company that organizes daily walking tours with local guides in more than 50 cities around the world. The New Orleans chapter has also produced a large number of YouTube videos that you can watch and get some ideas for your upcoming trip. And we have a link to their YouTube channel, and you'll find it in this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Hey, Sandy, we were talking about these over-the-top mausoleums, and if somebody has passed away and they're heading for that final home, it's probably going to come very likely with a jazz funeral. Where are you likely to see a jazz funeral, and how might you understand what's going on? Because this is a for real slice of the New Orleans traditional culture, isn't it?
Yeah. And a lot of our cemeteries are still active cemeteries. Even our oldest extant cemetery, St. Louis No. 1, is still an active, working Catholic cemetery. Jazz funerals, however, are expensive. But typically the way that a jazz funeral would work is that you have a brass band that is leading the procession to the cemetery, sort of playing a very somber dirge-like tune because you are mourning the person who has passed away. That person is usually being transported on a carriage that's drawn by a mule or a horse. And then once the body is interred within the actual mausoleum and you go to exit, then the brass band will strike up a lively tune in honor of the person's life and in celebration of life itself. And at that point, as it meanders through the city streets, sometimes other people would come in that weren't initially a part of the original family members or friend groupings and celebrate this person who's passed away.
And if you were a tourist who didn't know the family and you saw a jazz funeral, what would the etiquette be? You probably wouldn't be welcome to walk with the procession.
You know, I think if you're in the part where you're walking behind the coffin as it's being transported, I would feel uncomfortable in that stage of the procession. But once it's come out of the cemetery and you're in the celebratory aspect, I have seen strangers go in behind that procession because then it just becomes sort of a celebration of life itself. But I think, unfortunately, most tourists wouldn't recognize necessarily that aspect of a jazz funeral because they're so used to what are known as second line parades occurring because of things like wedding events.
So you'd see a musical procession and you might just mistake it for some other kind of festival.
Exactly. And they look very similar because typically when you come out of the cemetery, you'll see this moment where people pull out their kerchiefs and they're sort of shaking their kerchiefs to shake off the spirits of the dead so that they don't follow you home, which I always find hilarious when I watch these wedding events where they pull out the kerchiefs behind the second line and they're shaking. And I'm always like, what spirit are you shaking off? Is it like the spirit of the in-laws? Like, please don't let his family come for Christmas.
Sandy Hester only meant to stop over in New Orleans. But more than 20 years later, it's become her home. Sandy leads walking tours of the city for free tours by foot. She specializes in pointing out the city's history of its African diaspora, its voodoo culture, and the spookier elements that inspired the likes of Anne Rice to use New Orleans as the setting for vampire and ghost stories. Sandy's tours can be booked online at freetoursbyfoot.com under the link to New Orleans. You know, some aspect of New Orleans that's not necessarily something you'd talk about on your ghost tours, but it's an interesting dimension is the whole voodoo culture. It's kind of shrouded in mystery and secrecy, and a lot of people get a misunderstanding about it just from popular culture and movies and so on, but it's actually a religion for a whole slice of society. What is voodoo, and where does that come from, and how might we experience that in New Orleans?
So the connection with New Orleans to voodoo comes initially with the first shipment of enslaved Africans in 1719, and predominantly they're coming from the west coast of Africa, from Senegal, Gambia, down to Angola. And so they're going to bring those West African traditions over with them. And again, I've mentioned we're the northernmost Caribbean city, so that Afro-Caribbean culture being very strong, sort of allowing the religion of voodoo to flourish.
Because in Cuba, I've seen something like that, and it's mixing Catholicism with voodoo.
Yes. So in Cuba, there's going to be a similar tribe that's coming in predominantly to Cuba, the Yoruba. They're going to bring a religion that is often referred to as Ifa, and that religion will mix up in Cuba with Catholicism and here with Catholicism as well. But you often see that throughout the Caribbean. But I always like to caution people on a voodoo tour that initially it's not about true West African conversion. It's about them hiding West African religions within the iconography of Catholicism in order to keep their religions alive.
Oh, so enslaved people were not allowed to keep their former religion and they had to worship the same religion as their Catholic overlords, but they wanted to secretly keep their pre-slavery traditions as part of their way their children would grow up.
Yeah. The only recognized religion here would have been initially under the French and the Spanish was Catholicism.
Right.
But I mean, if you're enslaved and you've lost literally everything in the transatlantic slave trade, you want religion.
Right. And that survives to this day, and you can show it in tours that feature voodoo culture in New Orleans.
We do. We have an actual voodoo tour where we talk about the West African connections, and we talk about the different tribes and how it's progressed from those original religions to what would now be called voodoo in New Orleans today. And we also talk a lot about sort of where Hollywood goes wrong.
Yeah. Well, that's a great thing to do in your tours. Hey, Sandy Hester, thank you so much for joining us, and best wishes with your touring. And thanks for giving us a little insight into ghosts and cemeteries and spooky things in New Orleans.
Thank you so much.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of where and when at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. In my work, I've always measured profit, not in dollars earned, but by trips impacted. And after over 40 years of teaching travel, it's clear to me that if you equip yourself with good information and expect yourself to travel smart, you will. For us, content is king. That's why we offer a world of free content at ricksteves.com. All the TV shows we've ever produced, 50 hours of practical lectures, talks ranging from packing smart and tech on the road to cruising and language lessons, a thriving family of travelers comparing notes in our forum, and more. And again, it's all entirely free. It's at ricksteves.com.